From Loyola University Chicago School of Law and WLUW, this is The Podvocate. We are law students exploring the vanguard of the legal world with experts from our backyard and beyond. My name is Ben, and I'm a 2L here at Loyola and an associate editor of The Podvocate this year. In this week's episode, I sit down with Chief Defender of the Orleans Public Defender's Office, Danny Engelberg, to discuss the founding of the office as it is today, as well as the events that led to the office's remodeling after the events and destruction brought on by Hurricane Katrina. In doing so, we discuss what changes OPD has made, both administratively as well as systemically, in order to rebuild an office dedicated to long-term and sustainable community-centered holistic defense in New Orleans, Louisiana. Subscribe to The Podvocate wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about this episode and our guests, please visit our Instagram at The Podvocate. All right, everybody. Welcome back to The Podvocate. Today we have with us a very special guest coming to us from New Orleans, Louisiana, Mr. Danny Engelberg, who is the Chief Public Defender at Orleans Public Defender's Office. Danny, it's very nice to have you. Welcome to The Podvocate.
Thank you for having me.
So before we dive into today's topic, which is kind of the founding and the origin story of OPD as it is today, I was hoping just to start us off with a question that I like to ask all of my guests, which is, what was your favorite class in law school and why?
And hard to answer, but I would say one of my favorite classes was, like we were talking about just before we started recording, was evidence. It is such a sort of basic foundation to everything that we do, especially as public defenders and as trial lawyers, but also something that many lawyers don't have enough knowledge of. And it has so many different layers and complications, and so practical and for real life lawyering. So many of the classes we end up taking in law school, depending on what field you go into, don't necessarily have a straight line of usefulness. But if you're going into litigation and trial work, evidence is one of the most important classes you should begin to know.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I do feel as if a lot of courses that you take in law school, you know, don't always have immediate practicality, you know, in the practice of a lawyer every single day, depending on the field you go into. And I felt exactly what you just explained with evidence. It just felt very applicable to, like, you know, the day to day of a public defender. And it just kind of opens your eyes to, like, what, like, lawyering actually is and looks like in the courtroom.
Yes, and it's, you know, having it at your fingertips for anyone who does have an interest in either civil or criminal litigation or just litigation in general is going to be, it really is a core skill.
All right. Well, I'd like to move us into the topic for today. And for the listeners, I was hoping you could give us a bit of background on your origin story first. So while you were in law school, one, where did you go to law school? And two, while you were there, what specifically kind of sparked your interest in public defense, which ultimately led to you taking a job at OPD in 2007?
I was a 1L at the Georgetown University Law Center, and I remember seeing a flyer for a panel being done up in Capitol Hill, which Georgetown is just a few blocks away, for an MLK Day event. And who else was on the panel? But there were some famous people on the panel that I was attracted to, but I hadn't really heard of one of the panel members, a guy named Brian Stevenson, who immediately, once he started talking, it was almost like a light bulb went off in my head. And I was so, as many people have been, inspired by him and inspired by both the work he does, but also the work of starting the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. I did something that I normally wouldn't do. I'm not kind of super outgoing, walk up to people kind of guy. But I just was so taken by his words that after the event was over and people were packing up and leaving, I went up to him and said, "Everything you just talked about is why I went to law school and what I want to work on in my career." And he was very polite to me, as he always is, and very genuine, but obviously had a million things going on. And he gave me his card and he said, "Well, so, send me an email and your resume, and we'll see what we can do." And I really was probably the luckiest 1L that at least that I thought I was the luckiest 1L, when at the end of the line of following up immediately when I got back to my computer, I was able to clerk for him in the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama that summer. And there were only four of us, four law clerks at EJI. And at the time, it was a very small organization, and they gave us a tremendous amount of work and responsibility. And I was driving around Alabama, visiting people on death row who didn't have lawyers, who I was their only point of contact, and was assisting each of those clients with drafting some of their post-conviction relief applications. And vividly remember reading their transcripts and their trials, and being not only struck by the sort of injustice of the Alabama criminal legal system, but at the time just their individual trials and little attention was given them, and how if it had been someone who came from means or from a more privileged background, they would have had so much resources, the kitchen sink thrown in to defend them. But instead they were, kind of just given a lawyer name only, and being really struck by how that as a budding lawyer, that I and we as budding lawyers had the responsibility to do something when there is such blatant lack of equitable representation of people accused of crimes and facing long prison terms and even being executed by the state.
Yeah, I think, two things. One is I live by a rule, and the rule is always to go up and talk to somebody like Bryan Stevenson. If you're in a room with Bryan Stevenson, you go up and talk to him. So I would have done the same. I can't say that that opportunity is presented to many law students. So it's kind of surreal that that was kind of the moment for you, like that sparked your interest in this field. But I feel like the second thing you shared, which was just your overall experience at EJI and, seeing kind of going through trial by fire, I think it could be overwhelming, but I think oftentimes it's the best way for a young lawyer in practice to learn the job and to learn how things really are in the field. And I do think, I imagine that the sentiments that you shared with us is a common feeling shared amongst many lawyers in the public interest field, right?
Yes, and it just, you don't have to go far. You can go to any local courthouse and it just smacks you in the face. And it doesn't have to be someone on death row. It can just be someone facing a misdemeanor or anything in any courthouse, or over in civil court being evicted. It's just the amount of, let's just say this. We as lawyers, both through policy and also structures of creating a legal system, are ultimately responsible that that legal system is done equitably and fairly. And when that fails, as it all so often does, it's we as either future lawyers or lawyers that have the responsibility to do our part to fix that. And I do love the legal profession, but I feel like we have a lot of work to do and fall woefully short to fix the problems even just within our own profession.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's the right word for it, but it feels like a heavy burden to bear. And I often, I think, I'm sure lawyers, but I'm sure everybody kind of wishes that this didn't always fall to lawyers. And specifically in cases that we're going to talk about today, it falling to criminal defense lawyers as well, that, more people within the realm of this, policy, government would also take a hand in it. But it often does fall to lawyers. So, I mean, speaking of, I guess, heavy burdens and responsibilities falling to lawyers, I'd like to move into the origins of the Orleans Public Defender's Office, because I do feel as if, and for everyone listening, I actually had the amazing opportunity to come work with Danny this past summer at Orleans Public Defender's Office as a 1L law clerk. And I realized soon upon getting there that OPD has a very unique origin story. And compared to other offices around the country in major cities, it's relatively young. So I was hoping that we could kind of explore the origins of OPD. I know you arrived in 2007. But can we just talk a little bit about the events that led to the creation of the office as it is today?
Yes, and let me just say this, that even though our founding was not that long ago, and in 2006, 2007, we're about to hit our 60th anniversary of Gideon next year, and we are the whole as a such a critical constitutional right, we are far from getting it right as a public defender system. And so in as much that we are a story of a new public defender office that has really tried to hit the mark and represent our clients in a way that people should be represented, nationwide we're in a crisis. So it wasn't just New Orleans. This is a national crisis. But New Orleans, I think, was a bit of a canary in the coal mine as to that crisis. In 2005, August of 2005, in the days leading up, I think 1 week before Katrina hit, there were 6,492 people in our local jail for a city of just about 400,000. That number should it. I know numbers can be a little bit glossed over and sort of not mean much, but that number should be mind-boggling to people. Where you are, Ben, there's thousands of people in jail too, and we should be aware of how many people are in jail and what that percent of our city population is. But that was an immense amount of humanity in a sprawling jail complex of multiple jails and some of the worst conditions that you would be horrified to read about in war camps and prisoner of war camps. But yet in our own city of New Orleans, we had a sprawling crop complex of people who were locked up. And now that wasn't a secret to the community. Everyone knew someone who was a relative or a friend or someone who he may have worked with who either in jail or cycling in jail or in prison or cycling in prison. There were just so much many people who were wrapped up in the criminal system for things as small as marijuana or misdemeanor offenses to more serious charges, and all in that sort of complex of incarceration that spread on the eve of Katrina. And while everyone knew about it and felt it, it took that massive failure of our levees and flooding of over 90% of our city and flooding of our jails to see it all in one place and see it so symbolically. And the symbolism for those of us who remember it was quite stark. Of you could just see as people from that jail were being evacuated, just seas of orange jumpsuits in the just baking in the sun, waiting to be evacuated to far-flung places throughout the state. And so again, while the community knew it was happening and saw it on individual levels, it didn't feel it in a way that was so powerful as when the whole jail is evacuated once. And further making that so palpable and present to people and smacking people in the face was people just then were scattered through facilities away from New Orleans with no ideas where people were, and they just got lost. And so that sort of both the evacuation and the visual parts of the just masses of people who are just in our local jail system, plus then people just literally disappearing into places all throughout the state, really, I think, was a highlight for the community to see it in one place, for the city. And it galvanized those people who had been working in the trenches and wanting to fix what they knew to be a broken system for years and years. And it helped get some winds in their back to start to both highlight the problems with the overall system, but also the indigent defense public defender system that was part of that. And what was the public defender system before Katrina is still, you still see it in around the country. So it wasn't necessarily unique to New Orleans, but it was a system that was funded on traffic tickets to a almost insignificant amount of money and had no resources other than to pay private contract lawyers to sit in a section of court and sort of take whoever came into that section of court. And that was just a part-time job for those attorneys. And they also had to basically, to make a living, have a private practice to support themselves. And one of the things that was also quite striking about that system was that by being centered around a courtroom rather than a client, they missed the critical days from arrest till the person got to that courtroom, right? And they relied on sort of the court administration to even know, like, okay, here's my docket of clients. And saw on the docket was who they represented. And that led to a lot of people sitting in custody with no or extremely minimal representation from the time of arrest till they got to that courtroom. And one thing that folks don't know is in many parts of the country, Louisiana included, you can be arrested and not officially charged and get to an actual court for weeks and months. And so you're sitting unrepresented virtually for those weeks and months. And in some parts of the country, can be even years. So one of the sort of hallmark things that was a problem to the pre-Katrina indigent defense delivery system was the fact that, number one, it was woefully underfunded. And number two, because of that, they could only afford part-time lawyers to start representing people once they got really officially charged. That was in essence when the work started going. They also didn't have any, they had minimal support staff. They didn't have investigators. They didn't have client advocates. They didn't have social workers. They had very little administrative support. And the lawyers, even though they were part-time, had caseloads that exceeded 300, 400, 500 people at a time. So it was no mystery why there was almost 6,000 people in our local jail, and we were the biggest, most mass incarcerated state in the country. It's because the very people that were supposed to be a check on the system, to fight for clients, to reduce any prison or jail time, or protect innocence or overcharging, they just, they not only were fighting with both hands behind their back, but they were fighting both hands behind their back and blindfolded and with almost no shot at doing what they needed to do to represent their clients. And so once this exposure happened from that horrible disaster that killed many people and displaced so many from their homes, there was a real effort from people who've been wanting to work on this for years and years, with support from the local community, with support from folks from around the country, to rebuild a public defender office that tackled many of those ills I just mentioned. It would to not have lawyers be part-time, to not have wait to represent you people till after they're officially charged, to start representing people from arrest, to have you know, while not perfect caseloads, to have caseloads that could help them navigate and do their work, to have investigators, to have the support staff they need to fully and fairly represent their clients.
I think, you know, it's one, it's just quite the transition that I think the model of indigent defense in New Orleans has gone through for over the course of the last, what, 19 years. And, you know, I think as a student who arrived in New Orleans, had never been there before in my entire life, as someone who has not had personal experience navigating the criminal legal system or living in the state, I was naive to, you know, to realize how much of an impact Hurricane Katrina had on that city and continues to have on that city. I think especially people talk about Hurricane Katrina and the levee system failing and the flooding and the displacement of so many people. And I think that, you know, people fail often to recognize the impact that it had on people that were physically trapped in the criminal legal system. And it wasn't just like a human rights emergency. It was like a constitutional emergency as well, right?
Constitutional emergency, because it led to a lot of over-detention for a lot of people who, you know, were not only taken to places around the state and different facilities, but then had no access to court. And so there's a lot, hundreds and hundreds of stories of people in there on very minor charges who just got lost. And there were just some real heroic people who were there right almost immediately after to start trying to find people and locate them, to get them to access to some court processes, to then start, you know, identifying where they were and trying to get them released. There was that's also part of the OPD origin story, is the sort of the group of people who sprang into action. And not only did it highlight the failures of the criminal system in the years leading up to Katrina, but also highlight what just even, you know, what some dogged advocates could do to try to fix a crisis. And so with those advocates in that community that really sprang into action, I think there was building consensus that we could fix a longstanding problem and start having some semblance of fair and equitable representation from the public defender office.
It's, again, it's really hard to put in perspective, but 6,000 humans out of 400,000, that's like almost 2% of the entire population that was like locked mm-hmm. in a cement box when 90% of the city flooded. So if that doesn't show you, you know, that there needs to be a solid, well-resourced public defender infrastructure in place in a city like that, then I don't know what else does.
I point to not only just the sort of building a strong and full-time defender office says this, but there are other work of real that we were involved in and with our community partners supported. But today it's still too high, but the current jail population right now is about 1,200 people. And, you know, we had gotten that down to as low as 800 right after COVID. You know, if there isn't anything sort of as so, that is one of the most stark ways of seeing what a full-time public defender office can do to not only prevent a lot of unnecessary human suffering, but to get somewhat closer to a fair and equitable system, because we're still far away from that, but that's a very stark contrast today to where we were in 2005.
In line with that transition, I know you arrived at the office in 2007, so kind of early on in this transition infrastructure building period. And I'm curious, what were kind of the early steps taken to kind of put OPD on this path? And recognizing the work, is never done and no office is ever perfect, but to get where you all are today, what were some of the initial steps taken?
I mean, one of the hardest things, and it sounds simple and sounds like it should be something that could happen overnight, but one of the hardest things was to start representing people right at arrest. And so that was one of the sort of core changes. And you would, if you read somewhere that, oh, this office wasn't really providing robust representation from arrest onward, you would say that's a violation of the Sixth Amendment. Everyone would say that's a problem. And, yet that existed for years here, decades, and frankly is a big problem still, even in our 59th anniversary of Gideon. So that was one of our biggest, first, hardest things that we did. Also hard was to both find the resources to be able to staff the office with full-time staff rather than part-time contractors. Now, we still rely on many years later on contract attorneys from the private bar who do important and vital services for the clients that our office has a conflict with. But the fact that we developed a mostly full-time representation of clients from arrest, and then that was a big sea change, and that was probably those two things were some of the hardest things that we could do. You can't even begin to start having a public defender done the right way without basic resources. And so there was some initial funding that came about through the State Public Defender Act soon thereafter, and from philanthropic donations that really got us going and moving in the right direction. But we, even with those early reforms and changes, we lurched and have lurched from financial fiscal crisis to crisis, because we're still, vastly under-resourced and needing significant more resources to do the job the way that it should be done.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between horizontal and vertical representation and how your office kind of adapts to one of those models?
Yeah, there's some good offices that do both models, and so there is, I think the best practices that we try to follow is to have as much one continuous representation of the client that you can practically do. Now, the horizontal versus vertical means that you can have representation at one stage that gets handed off to a different lawyer at a different stage. Now, that can work as long as there is fully funded, zealous, hard charging representation at every level. One thing that vertical representation is an advantage to is that it starts connecting the team with their client early on. And this is a very stressful situation for someone, and complicated. And both knowing each other and getting to know the client and their family and their community really helps navigate sometimes complicated cases, even if, or complicated situations, even if the case itself isn't complicated. Someone's life might be in crisis or complicated, and how their life is going usually impacts the sort of outcome of a case, or often does. And so for us, we have seen much better both results, but also significant improved reputation of our office by having early, active, and continuous representation.
Yeah, it was one of the things, and I asked because, you mentioned this a couple of times so far, and it was one of the things that when I was in New Orleans this past summer really struck me was, I think, meeting the attorneys that I was assigned to work for, meeting their clients, and some of their clients they had been with for years. And just building up that relationship really helps obviously build the trust with the client, and just helps, for just hopefully, adds to a smoother navigation of the system, because it's often a very long process. And the second thing I wanted to touch on is you talked about this kind of making sure the office was well resourced, and that meant bringing on full-time staff. I think a lot of people outside the field might, consider full-time staff to mean just attorneys. But oftentimes in many public defenders' offices, there are people that aren't attorneys that work in these offices and play like a vital role in the, criminal defense process. And I was hoping you can speak a little bit about, OPD's community-centered representation approach and what kind of this holistic representation looks like.
Yeah, we've developed what we call the Client Service Division, which is composed of client advocates and social workers. And what we've seen is that one of the things that we can do, not only to improve someone's case and build trust with our clients in our community, but also just improve overall community health and well-being and safety, is that trying to address some of the root causes of why someone might have come in contact with the police or with the court and the criminal system. So we are averaging well over right now 1,000 plus services provided by that division a year, and that means things that really are just client driven of what their needs are, whether it's a health issue, a substance abuse issue, a mental health issue, a housing issue, schooling, work, things that are not directly court related, but impact the court, the case that's before them. Because if we can put someone in a better place, then after we're done, working with them, than they were when they first came in contact with them, everyone's better off, and the outcome for their case is usually better. So, we very much believe in that, both for improving our community and our city, but also for just results themselves for the case. And so that's been a big part of who we are as an office. And you mentioned non-lawyers. Another part of the office that is so critical is having an investigative team and legal assistance team, who all play just in critical just critical roles, as well as the administrators in our business office, that make us be able to do the work we can and have the resources we need to do our job. So it is. It really does take a village to do this work, and one part of it can't exist without the other. We don't necessarily view ourselves as the lawyer or the investigator. We're all a particular client team that are working towards best representing that client to the best of our abilities.
And it's really amazing that you have all of these resources, and everybody really works together really well, in providing, a comprehensive, holistic representation for these clients. I think, again, I don't mean to speak for everybody, but I do feel as if some people that might not have experience in this field, they kind of look to lawyering as like this, it's like the savior complex, where like the lawyer is responsible for, everything that has to do with the client and the representation and the whole process. And in reality, as you said, I mean, it takes a village. And
Yeah,
it's
I mean, the lawyer obviously is the one speaking in court, but every person who's a lawyer in our office would say that without their team, they can't do the court part of things. And that any time that we do a One thing we say when we interview folks is, no matter what position, is, why do you want to be a public defender? Because every person in this office is a public defender. And, you know, for those students who are listening to it and you're thinking about, do I want to do X or Y or Z? You know, our office, I'm a big fan of, but one thing to look at is whether, you know, the people that you are working with are dedicated and care and share a passion for the work. And that really is a, it's kind of an irreplaceable work experience to have that, because there's many places where that's not the case. But to be in a special work environment where, you know, in our office, 120 people or 100 plus people are have the same vision, the same mission, and really care about that vision and mission, and when and all parts, whether it's lawyer, non-lawyer, investigators, client advocate, administrator, legal assistant, social worker, to have all parts rowing in the same direction with those same vision and mission in mind is pretty special work experience.
You know, looking back since you've arrived in 2007, you know, you talked about some of the initial goals for the office. You know, how do you feel as if OPD as it is today has kind of met a lot of those goals? And looking to the future, you know, what continue to be some of, you know, your office's priorities?
We are in many ways, we have a very sort of simple mission with obviously very complicated parts, but you know, we are there to represent our clients and the community, and it's rooted in the client work. And so I would say one of the things that has been a big stark difference is this, just the reputation of the public defender office, and also the sort of sense in the community among our clients and community that, you know, that you're not going to get a raw deal if you get if a public defender is representing, you know, yourself or a loved one, and that you can get some of the best representation money can't buy, as some people say. And so I think that in of itself, because, you know, in addition to what we were talking about the sort of the values and the passion, the care that people have at the Orleans Public Defender's Office and other public defender offices, it's some of the most talented, capable people that I've ever been around. And that is just and another special part about going to work at a public defender office is just, you're around not only people who care, who are work hard, who have good sense of humor, who are great colleagues to be around, but are just some of the most talented people that you could ever work around. And so I think when you have all that, and you have an ethic of being rooted in, you know, not just the courthouse and the sort of the walls of the courthouse, but in the community itself, then, you know, it does percolate out and the community takes notice. And, you know, we know from a lot of different folks who have both seen it before and after, but also who are living it, just how much our reputation has improved and changed over the years. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, we want to continuously trying to make our place a more livable and healthier and safer city. And actually more incarceration and more imprisonment does not do that. It does not make us safer. It doesn't. And so not only fighting against the forces of increased and mass incarceration and more people in prison and jail, but also, you know, improving access to community resources and lifting people up who are struggling, and getting people to in our office to really buy into that, you know, we represent and work with and partner with each client as a whole person, not just, you know, they're not just, you know, obviously they're not just a number, they're not just a case file, they're a real whole person, and continuing to both find the resources to do that, but also just, you know, doing it day in and day out. Yeah, you know, there's literally thousands of people that come through the office every year that we partner and represent with, you know, and partly there's a lot to, more work to do, but partly it's like just making sure that we have the folks who can continue to do the work day in and day out.
Fight. And I never think that there's ever going to be kind of like a time where a public defender's and a public defender's office can kind of stay, sit, and be like, all right, we have everything we need. We don't need anything more. It's constant advocacy. And, I want to just briefly talk about something that you've kind of, part of advocacy for this office, but also public defender's offices nationwide. This continues to be a problem really in every state, every major city. Is the concept of pay parity. I know that you've been engaged with that type of advocacy at OPD since you arrived, and I was hoping you can just talk a little bit about, what that issue is and kind of where is it today.
Yeah, sure. I mean, everything is when Gideon was decided, it didn't it just said this is a right. You states and counties and parishes and cities, you just go figure it out. And so there's a real patchwork of systems that are, many of which are fundamentally flawed due to just resources. And I would just say, Ben, it pay parity is important. We need people to be paid to do the work, then be able to sustain the work, because the more turnover there is, the more the worse it is for not only obviously our office and our client, but also the entire criminal system as a whole. But I would say that it's more resource parity, right? And New Orleans as a city is as even a progressive city, has traditionally sp spent hundreds of millions, tens of millions, and hundreds of millions of dollars on law enforcement and policing and prosecuting and jailing, and almost nothing on defending. And so that was sort of the root of where OPD was founded and started. And so one of the things that we started doing was going to our local city council and pointing out the vast disparity of resources to what the district attorney gets. Now, not even speaking about the law enforcement arms and the jail, because that would even endorse even the district attorney. But the vast disparities between the district attorney who and the public defender office. And we, after years of advocacy, we passed a municipal law that mandated resource parity between attorney's office and the public defender office, so that if the parish government was going to fund the district attorney's office, they had to do equitable funding for the public defender office. And that law passed. Honestly, that was a sea change for our office. And as I said before, before that law passed, we lurched from financial and fiscal crisis to financial and fiscal crisis, even though and proud of the work that we were doing. We were always, we were always dealing with some shortage, either clients not getting lawyers, people had to get laid off or furloughs, just in a cycle of just of crisis. And so when our local council and the mayor stepped up and passed this law, it really, for the first time since I've been here, we were able to breathe and have some relative stability. And so one of the things that I think everyone should look at is, so what is the funding for prosecutors on a state level, and what is the funding for prosecutors on a municipal or local or county level or a city level, and demand that there is the resource parity, not just pay parity, but resource parity for both prosecution and defense. That's a real, like, bipartisan, doesn't matter what side of the spectrum you are politically, issue that, the big arm of the state is trying to incarcerate or charge individuals that we need as a society to be a check on that, and to have protections against the state. And so we are real proud that we were able to get that that law passed and able to start to, instead of fighting with two hands behind her back and blindfolded, we're still vastly under-resourced and going against massive resources for law enforcement and prosecution and jailing. But maybe now we just have one hand behind her back instead of both hands behind her back.
And kind of moving on to, from the general model of OPD as it is today, I kind of wanted to briefly talk about, your path to leadership within the office. I know that you kind of transitioned into the role of chief defender, somewhat recently, and I was wondering, what your kind of immediate priorities were for the office.
Well, we had been, as I said, dealing with financial and fiscal crises. And so one of the most immediate priorities is to recruit and staff up the office to start to get to the appropriate levels to do the work. And so we've been, working very hard to do that. Also, it doesn't matter how much you recruit and staff up if you don't make a place a good place to work and a sustainable place to work. It doesn't serve our clients or community, and certainly the people who work here. So we've done a ton of work to, and this is ongoing work. Before I became chief defender, I was deputy chief defender and chief of trials. So I all of a sudden switched on a dime. I many ways just continued the work of my predecessor, but really just focusing on making sure that the people who work here and all our colleagues are supported in the work and can sustain the work, and that they can do the work that many of us really truly love for as long as to do it in a way that isn't just running as fast and hard as you can and burning out, but just doing it in a sustainable way that people can take care of themselves and still do good work. And not burn out. And that starts with both the culture of an office, but also the support we can do for each other. And so those are some big priorities that we've worked on and continued on. We know that throughout history, whenever you take a step forward, there's always a step back, right? And so one of the things that has kind of smacked me in the face this first year is just how you can never let your guard down. You can never sort of just be like, it's all good. We're done. It's, I'm not saying that in a way to feel sorry for ourselves, because in fact, I think a lot about the people that have laid the foundation for where we are today, and the civil rights warriors and people who are on doing the work here locally and nationally for criminal justice change, that they didn't just feel sorry for themselves or kind of rest on their laurels. That as just as they kept pushing and kept vigilant, we have to do the same today.
And in the name of kind of, promoting and cultivating a positive work environment and increasing recruitment efforts, which is, I think a goal for many public defenders offices around the country. I was hoping before we officially close out, now that the listeners kind of have a sense generally of the history of Orleans Public Defender's Office as it is today, as well as, your kind of vision for the office, I was hoping you can kind of speak directly to our student body. And, as the chief defender at OPD, what would you kind of say is your short pitch to students like myself and many others at Loyola and across law schools in Chicago who are interested in both kind of the field of public interest, but also more specifically in the field of, public defense?
Yeah, no, I think one of the most important things that people can do with the privilege of a law degree is to make sure that they engage in the public interest, whether it's in our work or some other work. And even if you're in doing private work, that you maintain a public interest focused eye on what you do with any free time that you may have. And so I'd say that, it's not only something that is, the right thing to do, but it's an obligation. We as lawyers and you students who are future lawyers, you have a real obligation and frankly responsibility to make to and not to be cheesy about it, to make the world a better place, but specifically to make the legal system a better place. And I'm biased. I don't think there's any other place that is like more ground zero and critical to do that than a public defender office. But there are just a lot of different ways and a lot of different needs for public interest work, whether that's your career or something that you do as part of your practice and support.
I think that we've covered a lot of topics today, but I think that this was a good kind of full lens look at what OPD is and its values and the work that it does. And before we kind of close out this episode, at least, I wanted to kind of tie us back around to the very start, and it's kind of out of the field of OPD in New Orleans, but speaking about classes you took at law school, what would you say is your least favorite class you ever took?
I remember taking a class in international law and feeling like a bit helpless that it was being enforced by sort of general morality rather than and consensus rather than any having like teeth in that. And so I really liked it, especially and especially the human rights aspects of the law, but I remember feeling a little bit discouraged that it was so easily ignored without any consequences.
Yeah, I mean that's a common theme, and you see it. We won't get into it right now, but you see it playing out in the world today with current events, right? So yeah, I've heard really amazing things about international law. I hope to take it, but again, as you mentioned, you just have to be wary of the enforcement mechanism that is, that international law lacks. Amazing. So Danny, those were all the questions I had left for you. And Danny, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day, for joining us at the Podvocate. Really happy to have you.
Thank you, Ben, and it's great to see you.
And that is all from us here at the Podvocate. Thanks again for joining us today. Our team does want to hear from you, and if there is a topic you want the show to cover, please email us at thepodvocate@luc.edu. And also visit our Instagram at thepodvocate for more information on this episode and our guests. The Podvocate is produced by WLUW, the student-run independent radio station broadcasting from the School of Communications at Loyola University Chicago. Our editors-in-chief are Neka Ugu and Andy Vandenbush. Our senior editors are Casey Callahan and Marcus McNeil. Our associate editors this year are Johannes Alvarez Rivero, Karan Kushal, Maris Medina, and myself, Ben Recht. Special thanks to Associate Director of Student Affairs, Professor Radhika Sutherland, and Dean Stephen Rushen for providing the resources and support to make this show possible. And finally, from Loyola University Chicago School of Law, this has been The Podvocate.